Hey everyone, welcome to the podcast Too Much Disinformation, the pod that uncovers the good, the bad, and the fake of the online world. I'm your host, Rafi Mendelson, and on today's pod, we're going to be discussing elections, and specifically whether elections are under threat, and if they are under threat, you know, what is impacting them, what is influencing local electorates, what can we do about it as well. And so that's what we're going to be talking about, unpacking a pretty serious but important topic. And thankfully, there are people and organizations who are at the forefront of fighting that charge. And we have one of them to talk us through today, Daria Azariev-North. Daria is the program manager at the International Foundation for Electoral Systems. And her work is really focused on building democratic institutions and civil society to ensure election integrity, which is what we're going to be discussing today, and also countering foreign influence in democratic processes. A European American from Chicago and now based in DC, she's also spent time at the Atlantic Council and the Center for Strategic and International Studies. So without further ado, let's start. Hi, Daria. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rafi. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's really, really great to have you. I'm really looking forward to the conversation because we're going to be talking about something that we at SIABRA spend a lot of time focused on, which is elections, which is, you know, what kind of consumes your days, really, in terms of thinking about elections integrity. Before we go into the topic, however, I have to ask you what your first ever social media platform was.
Well, I think like everyone, I did have a MySpace, but I think that if we think about it, the precursor really to all social media was AOL Instant Messenger. And that is what really defined my first era of being online. And so if you think about it, you know, there were screen names, we had away statuses, buddy lists. My screen name was American Angel 459. So very classic for, you know, a 13-year-old at the time. But yeah, I thought it was amazing to be able to stay in touch with friends from different countries.
The fact that you remember your handle means that you either have a great memory or you're still active on AOL Messenger right now.
Oh, absolutely.
And was that through dial up, right? You had to kind of dial up modem. Access
that I set up myself as a 13-year-old. I was very proud of it.
amazing. Cool. So let's dive straight into the topic of what we're going to be talking about. But actually, first, I wanted to kind of ask you how you know, found yourself, you know, in this field. You've worked at NGOs. I know elections and kind of strong democracies is something that is quite close to your heart, but maybe for a reason that's different to others.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually have a very personal connection to it. I'm a first generation American of Polish and Russian descent. So my dad's side, he was a Polish. He considered himself a Polish citizen, but he was of Russian descent. His great grandfather was actually a Russian ethnographer that got exiled from Russia for revolutionary propaganda. And that's how he ended up in Poland. And then my father's father was a general for the White Army. And so when my dad was 14, they actually had to flee to Germany. They ended up being political refugees there. And then my dad came over on a ship to the U.S. alone at the age of 18. His parents actually didn't get permission to come with him. And then he put himself through school, went to Loyola Northwestern, became a well-known journalist in the Polish diaspora. And he used to really enjoy bringing people together around different cultural causes and issues. So that's always something that really inspired me. My mom's side is Polish, and my grandmother lived through two world wars, you know, ended up on different sides of the border, of the Polish border throughout her life. And so I've always just had such a deep admiration for people who, you know, put their life on the line for higher ideals and democratic values. And so for me, it's really an honor to be a small part of that through my work now. You know, we're seeing it across the world today in Ukraine, wow. for, foremost.
Incredible. And so when you talk about that work that you're doing, I mean, and amazing to have such a strong emotional connection. But what is that work kind of in a nutshell? I know the task is massive and your role is huge, but what is the, in a nutshell, what is it that you do on a day-to-day basis?
Sure. So I manage several of our democracy building programs in Europe. That includes Belarus, but also a regional program that is designed to bring electoral stakeholders together from the region, really to help them share different experiences on, you know, what are the shared challenges to democracy today. And that includes both old and new challenges. Disinformation and foreign influence are obviously a very big piece of that. So we bring them together and try to identify what are, you know, the lessons learned, what are good practices that we can identify, how can we learn from each other and develop tools to support democratic resilience in the region globally.
Wow. Wow. And we have, you know, just in the region that you cover, we have elections, you know, taking place all the time. You know, we have in Turkey, we have in a few days, and I think Poland coming up, as well as other places. In terms of elections, in terms of the health, you know, either globally or particularly the regions that you cover, how are they looking? What is the health? I know that might sound a strange question to ask, but what is the health of elections and elections integrity as we find ourselves in 2023?
Well, I have to say, sadly, it is quite dire, I think. There's, you know, a lot of serious threats right now. Foreign influence is one of the greatest threats to elections right now, and therefore democracy. You know, foreign interference isn't a new phenomenon at all. We can go all the way back to George Washington in his farewell address in 1776, you know, called on the American people to be constantly awake to the risks posed by the influence of foreign powers, which practiced the arts of seduction to mislead public opinion. But now, today, obviously, with the digital age and social media, you know, the power that foreign influence has to proliferate and expand its reach has really increased the threat to elections and democracy. And it's really become a Hydra-headed challenge, I would say. So, you know, a good or a strong manifestation of that is we know that in the last decade, Russia and China have cumulatively spent more than $600 million interfering in the democratic processes of more than 22 countries. So we know that, you know, Russia and China are the main actors when it comes to foreign interference, but obviously there's also other foreign actors that are taking, you know, taking part in foreign interference in elections, whether that's Iran in the Middle East, as you would know, or, you know, recently we saw even other examples of that, whether it's Erdogan Qatar trying to, you know, buy off members of the European Parliament. So we're also seeing a global decline in democracy, actually, with growing authoritarianism around the world. And so when you think about it, elections are actually increasingly under threat, both from, you know, externally and internally. And you asked about the health of elections. I actually think elections are kind of like a, you know, physical for a country's democratic health, because you go to vote at one point in time, but really the results of that are, you know, the manifestation of the health of these democratic processes that are occurring throughout the year. And there are so many different components that go into that, right? Because there's more than anything, there's public trust, right? Public trust in democratic institutions and the electoral process themselves, how engaged people are in those processes and whether they feel that they have a voice and whether they want to express that. And, you know, on top of that, you have these narratives that are really fighting for people's attention on a daily basis, not just during the elections, but all year round. And as part of that, you have these foreign malign actors like Russia and China who are continuing to increase their strategies and tactics.
So when it comes to foreign interference, you know, we have this definition, we have this term but I don't think it's always so clear to most people in terms of the definition. That might be partly because it's constantly evolving. You know, you mentioned this kind of Hydra challenge. What is foreign interference?
Foreign interference, or you know, foreign influence, is really, it's any attempt by a foreign actor to subvert, corrupt, coerce, undermine the integrity of a country's electoral and democratic process more broadly. So anything that is not, you know, in line with the organic national interest of a country and its organic processes.
And what does that look like? If you're in a country, you have an election coming up, what does that, you know, bringing it down to the kind of the everyday, the common, you know, witnessing of it, what is an example of foreign interference in action?
Well, that's, I think, you know, the core of the problem is that there are so many different manifestations of it. It can be anything from a cyber attack, right? It can be an attack that directly targets, for example, an election management body or another democratic institution to undermine its credibility. It can be obviously different forms of foreign funding, which are increasingly, you know, that's also one of the greatest challenges that there is, because we're seeing that across the board. It's really hard to track, and there still aren't, you know, that strong of systems and frameworks in place to track foreign funding and ensure transparency. And then, of course, you know, the other biggest piece of it are disinformation narratives and propaganda. Mm. So those narratives can come in so many different forms. They're not always obvious in terms of, you know, it's not always something that is evidently trying to target an election or a democratic process. In Europe right now, you know, we're seeing the Kremlin trying to proliferate a lot of narratives that around Ukrainian refugees in different countries, whether it's Poland, Moldova, Georgia, trying to, you know, disseminate narratives that are painting Ukrainian refugees in a negative light, because that is, you know, part of the Kremlin's parallel war. You have the kinetic war on the ground, and then you have an entire parallel second information war that the Kremlin is undertaking as part of this. And so all of, you know, the foreign influence efforts that the Kremlin is currently undertaking, including, I think, what will be a big part of its efforts ahead of the Polish parliamentary elections this year, is to reduce support for the war in Ukraine, to reduce, you know, support both on a national level, on a military level, and people's awareness and conscience.
And then how's that moving into the social media space, into the online space? You know, what are the tactics that we're seeing, and how are governments and or malicious actors able to use social media as a platform to affect foreign influence?
Well, we're seeing it in a variety of ways, right? It's everything from, you know, various bots and accounts to actual media organizations being bought out by foreign actors. But we're also, for example, seeing authoritarian regimes expanding their own strategies and tactics. So Belarus is a really good example of this. You know, it was a regime that has disseminated propaganda and disinformation narratives for decades. But primarily, this was always taking place on traditional state TV media channels. And since the controversial August 2020 presidential elections and the consequent, you know, peaceful protests, which were really incredible because we saw such an unprecedented level of civic awareness among Belarusians, which was really impressive. And also what poses, you know, one of the greatest threats to the Kremlin is, you know, this type of civic awakening. And so in an effort to undermine that, the regime has actually expanded its tactics and moved into the online social media space. They've shut down various social media platforms like Tutve and Nexa. And, you know, it gets worse than that because, you know, the repressions are very serious in terms of, you know, now you can get arrested on the street in Belarus for having the wrong meme on your phone. So it's a very serious and deeply rooted and complex challenge. And it's incredibly important that we're raising awareness and thinking about how can we approach this collectively to protect democratic resilience and stability regionally and globally.
And when we talk about election integrity and foreign influence, it's actually not a new concept. And I think most people are aware of that, you know, especially if you look at the 2016 US elections. I think that was a big moment where people, you know, certainly not the beginning of it, but that's a moment where people thought, okay, this is an example. This is what, you know, all these warnings, I now see this in action. So how long has it been going on for, and how has that evolved on social media and over what period of time?
So as I mentioned in the beginning, I mean, foreign influence has been going on historically since 1776, long before that as well. But with social media, those tactics have really changed. And what's, you know, troubling is that we're seeing China also enter this space. And for China, this is a much newer arena for deploying the regime's broader strategy for global hegemony. But unlike with the Kremlin, you know, with the Kremlin, we've now been quite familiarized with the Kremlin playbook for, you know, over a decade now or longer. But for China, these are new strategies. It's interesting because at the moment, we can still say that the Chinese tactics and tradecraft isn't quite as sophisticated as the Kremlin's is.
Interesting. It's
usually much more, you know, disorganized. But at the same time, you know, we're still also learning and growing familiar with Chinese tactics and the fact that this is also a real threat. And the pandemic actually showed us this in so many different ways. For China, you know, in Europe, especially, COVID provided an enormous opening to really manipulate public perception and create for itself a more positive image in Europe by spreading narratives about how the West has abandoned Europe during the pandemic you know, for different reasons in terms of, you know, lack of access to vaccines or other equipment that was necessary. So I think we can also be sure that Chinese strategy will also continue to evolve and improve and grow more sophisticated. And in addition to that, we're seeing examples of how Russia and China also sometimes are increasingly collaborating together on some of these narratives.
I think it's fascinating when you mention about the Russian playbook and how there's, you know, 10, 15 plus years of experience. I actually had the opportunity a few months ago to meet Garry Kasparov, who, you know, chess legend from the Soviet Union, originally from Baku in Azerbaijan, and was this Russian chess supremo who was held as really as an icon, but then actually became quite critical against. He now often speaks about Russian influence, disinformation, and he said that these are the playbooks that they were using, you know, on their own people. So it's really interesting how A, that that's evolved, B, how you can almost map different countries and their capabilities next to each other and how some have evolved in kind of slightly different ways. When it came to the pandemic, I think that's really interesting that when it comes to disinformation, so we started talking about elections and now we're talking about a pandemic, which wasn't centered around election and wasn't around a 2-3 month period of time. So is this an always on behavior? Is this an always on tactic, a state of, you know, malicious actors wanting to affect change and looking at any opportunity, and what's the order of the day?
Yeah, I would say that, yes, it is. And especially in today's day and age, you know, with for China and Russia, this is really a means of realizing their political aspirations globally. The targets may change, the strategies may change, but usually the goal is always the same. And the pandemic simply highlighted, you know, existing risks and vulnerabilities. So especially from the elections perspective, I think it taught us some very valuable lessons because it highlighted that, you know, there were existing vulnerabilities to standard electoral practices, when it comes to disinformation, when it comes to foreign influence, when it comes to dealing with crises and communicating to the public. And so I think the silver lining of that is that there were very valuable lessons for democratic resilience that came out of that, that I think there's, you know, increasing awareness about. And so I think the pandemic taught the election world the importance of being proactive and being prepared, preparing not when you are in crisis mode, but ahead of time. So learning how to anticipate what are the key challenges and what are the key high-risk narratives that you might expect, and having messaging that is, you know, appropriately prepared for that. And as part of that, the biggest piece is knowing the importance of communicating with the public in order to build public trust. Because, you know, when it comes to elections, there's really two different pieces that constitute, you know, a free and fair democratic election. There's the process itself, which should be credible, transparent, democratic. But then there's also the public credibility and trust in that process. And so that's where there's always an enormous opening for foreign interference and for undermining people's perception and belief in the credibility and in the credibility of that process. And that's why it is so incredibly important that election management bodies, democratic institutions, proactively communicate and understand how can they, you know, communicate their values. How can they, you know, lead with facts? How can they partner with other stakeholders to serve as validators for kind of building that trust?
So I definitely want to ask you about the role of the democratic institutions, but first, it occurred to me that, you know, when we talk about social media and online experience as a whole, that's a lot of different destinations, for want of a better word, where people spend their time. Is it happening in one social media platform, on one website more than others? You know, what are we talking about, and how does it, you know, how does it happen across the different sites?
I think we're seeing it everywhere, you know, and then that's a part of the proliferation that we're talking about. And I think that's part of what is really magnifying this threat, is the fact that these threats are now crossing, you know, different types of borders. They're crossing physical country state borders and different platforms. And depending on the country, you know, it's adapted. You know, if based on the goal. So if you're trying to target a country where the majority of users are on Twitter, or if the majority of users, say in Eastern Europe, are on Telegram or on VK, that's where you're seeing those different strategies. And then on top of that, you know, the nature of the digital age and the hyperconnectivity that we are a part of makes it so that, you know, some narrative can start somewhere, for example, on someone's private account. And then we've seen examples of how in the course of several hours, that narrative can go from someone's public private account to, you know, mass media. So in a matter of hours, let alone days. And then it actually can jump from, you know, different forms of media. So it can go from online media to find its way to state, you know, TV and radio channels. And so these narratives have a lot of power. And that's why people's awareness and media literacy is incredibly important.
I think that's such a powerful thing to think about, of how it can jump from different mediums. And then you think about your own individual media usage over the course of a day or a week. It's not with one platform. We tend to share around. There's lots of demands of our interests. So the fact that it can kind of spread and move from one, it's not contained, is very interesting. We've spoken a lot about the challenges and the situation right now, which isn't all particularly rosy in all aspects. So let's move to the positive and the proactive. What can be done and what is being done in order to ensure the integrity of elections?
Well, I think perhaps it's because I'm an optimist, but I'm also, you know, I think seeing a lot of positive things in my work on a daily basis. And so that leads me to believe that out of this crisis also comes a great opportunity. I think it's an opportunity to make democracies more resilient with more enduring democratic structures and also more informed, engaged, and inclusive societies. And I think that's really the answer. So we have to approach the challenge of foreign influence in elections from a holistic perspective. And that's really what we strive to do at IFES as part of my work. So we believe that if you have a holistic approach to it, which includes several different pillars, then we have a shot, you know, at protecting democracy and electoral integrity and reversing some of these really concerning trends that we're seeing. So I would say the first big piece of that is, as I was saying, you know, creating resilient, independent, democratic institutions that are transparent and that are able to build and maintain public trust. And as part of that, there's several different pillars, right? So it's, you know, democratic institutions and election management bodies' ability to combat disinformation and to respond to it proactively. Cyber security is obviously another really important piece of that. And then, of course, corruption is such a key entry point and foreign funding. So looking at how we can, you know, increase transparency in campaign spending that will bring attention to foreign funds being used both by national actors and actors outside the country. And then separate from that, as I was saying, the other piece of that is public awareness and understanding. And so media literacy, I would say, is probably one of the most critical, powerful tools out there for empowering civic awareness and democratic resilience. A big piece of that is civic education. But really, if we think about, you know, how can we counter such foreign influence tactics, it really comes down to having people being able to identify and understand those tactics. So looking at how can we teach mindful consumption of information in the digital age? And that really includes critical thinking skills more than anything, you know, knowing how to use fact-based arguments, consensus building, the ability to evaluate different sources of information. I think kind of to your point, what you were saying about Kasparov, you know, in Russia, for example, right now, there's such an internal fight that is also having, you know, regional and global impact, right, in terms of the narratives that are being spread by the regime as to the justification behind the war in Ukraine. And the challenge is that, you know, these people have been entrenched in disinformation and propaganda for decades. And part of that goes deep into the educational system, the Soviet style classroom, where individual thinking, critical thinking skills are absolutely not a part of a young person's education. And so that's something we think a lot about when we talk about civic education. Media literacy is encouraging individual thinking and critical thinking. And more than anything, I think inspiring young people that to believe that they have a voice and they have a role in their societies and communities, and that, you know, being a citizen is both a right and a responsibility. And, you know, that then includes being active in a country's democratic and electoral process throughout the whole cycle.
And so those would be tactics, excellent tactics on the individual society level. What are the kind of tactics on the government level? You know, what are the public institutions, what are they able to do to be able to fight this wave that is disinformation?
I mean, another enormous opening is for foreign interference is polarization, polarized societies. That's oftentimes, you know, the greatest opportunity for foreign actors to come in and exacerbate, you know, existing cleavages within society. And so from both a governmental and civil society perspective, it's so important to look at how can you build inclusive societies, because when people become disenfranchised from the political process, that's really when there are cracks that are open to autocracy and foreign influence. And that includes, you know, everyone, whether it's women, young people, persons with disabilities, ethnic minorities. It's really important. And, you know, we see that on a daily basis in terms of narratives, whether it's the way that women are portrayed in the media, you know, there's gender disinformation and hate speech that is also, you know, an enormous challenge and a threat in and of itself. The narratives that I mentioned about Ukrainian refugees that we're seeing all across Europe right now, those are meant to create tensions within communities. And so if you find ways to build unity and cohesive communities with shared values, then that's a really strong deterrent to foreign influence.
Mm. So a multi-hybrid challenge needs a multi-pronged solution. And it certainly sounds like you and your colleagues are thinking and working on that. Where can people follow your work or your research or to hear and read more about some of the things we've covered today?
Well, I'll be happy to share some links. We have our website, ifas.org, that highlights a lot of our successes and ongoing work. Our regional Europe program, that's run out of our office in Prague. I'm actually excited to be going there on Monday for a few weeks, including to lead a conference on combating disinformation for election management bodies. We also have our own webinar series that we started during the pandemic, actually, because so much of our work consists of bringing people together in person. Obviously, the pandemic presented a really big challenge in terms of how do we keep electoral stakeholders engaged in that time. So we came up with this webinar that's now had a few different iterations and names, but currently it's called Democratic Resilience in Europe. You can watch all the recordings, all 26 iterations on our YouTube channel. So I can also share that link as well.
Amazing. And we'll include the links of everything you mentioned in the show notes so that people can find it pretty easily. We like to finish by asking everyone that comes on the show to name us one good thing, one bad thing, and one fake thing that they are seeing in the online space today.
Sure. I'll start with one thing bad. So, you know, as I was saying, the online space has become such a powerful tool for foreign influence and authoritarian regimes in growing ways. They're continuing to develop new strategies, transitioning from traditional media to social media channels. And I think we're really seeing in the last few years how disinformation is becoming more mainstreamed and politicized. And you have foreign actors joining, you know, strategies and efforts. You're in terms of, you know, one thing fake, you're also seeing a lot of people, you know, people like influencers have an enormous following, their own credibility. They're able to reach a lot of people, you know, in a very short amount of time. And oftentimes they actually have a greater level of credibility than the average media news outlet. And so it's really important that these people also have proper information hygiene, because whether it's intentional or unintentional, often sometimes they can disseminate some of these narratives from foreign malign actors as well.
Mm.
When we, you know, talk about hyperconnectivity and how we were talking about how something can, you know, travel across different platforms so quickly. If we're going back to elections, you know, we've seen different examples how if a certain narrative gets disseminated at the right time, I mean, it can be a day before an election or a week, it has the power to reach thousands of people and actually sway an election. And so, again, that's where it's incredibly important that we have that awareness and media literacy, and we're working together across sectors, really, to address this threat and challenge. And then I think that brings me to the one good thing that, you know, this tool, social media, the online space that is right now posing one of the greatest threats to elections and democracy, It also has the power to be one of the most effective and, you know, solutions. So you can use social media and technology for good, and we have to remember that, whether that's using influencers to reach young people to help, you know, counter disinformation narratives, using chatbots for one-on-one outreach, or creating counter disinformation news channels, for example, to reach people in marginalized territories, border territories, where they're not able to actually access credible local information. And I think all of that points to the fact that it is democracy's moment right now. I believe that. I think the war in Ukraine is really showing that to us. And I think that incredible spirit and resolve of Ukrainian people that we're seeing, as well as the global support that we're seeing for that, is really a testament to civic awareness and how it fuels, you know, democratic resilience.
Well, thank you for ending on a happy and a good note. And also thank you so much for taking the time to talk it through. I thought it was fascinating, really interesting topic, really huge challenge, one that I think, you know, cannot be understated, the health of our democracies. So, you know, thank you for talking that through. And thank you to everyone listening wherever you are. Have a great day, everyone. Bye.